You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 193 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Problems of Society, An Esoteric View, From Luciferic Past to Ahrimanic Future. 9 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 3, given in Zurich on the 11th of February, 1919. As people interested in the anthroposophic movement, as I said a week ago, we are in a position to substantially deepen and more fully comprehend the burning social issues of today, and to recognize what humanity needs at present. We can find a proper view and stance toward these issues, one deeper than is possible in the broad public domain. If I may speak in biblical terms, we can see ourselves as a kind of leaven, with each person, wherever they live, contributing something especially needed at present out of their deeper feelings and impulses. Recalling the basic tenor of the public lectures, we see the need today to seek for a certain division and structuring of the social organism. The word seek is important, indicative not of some kind of revolutionary program we want to realize as soon as possible, but an effort to create a certain organized division of what has become centralized under various modern influences. Instead of the so-called centralized state, we wish, alongside other spheres of the social order, for a distinct and independent sphere to develop, comprising everything that relates to spiritual life, to culture, education, teaching, art, literature, and also, as I have indicated, and will touch on tomorrow in the public lecture, all that relates to the administration of civil and criminal law. A second sphere of the social organism should encompass more strictly what has so far been called the state, which in modern times, influenced by the preceding 4 centuries, has been invested with all kinds of diverse tasks, state education, and so on. Under the influence also of socialist and social ideas, people seek nowadays to weld together economic life and what one can truly call the political life of rights into a single unity. Both need to pull apart again. As a second autonomous sphere of the social organism, the political state must be distinct and separate from the third sphere, an independent, relatively independent economy, comprising the circulation of goods and commodities. Today, I would like to consider this subject from a perspective that will not be so easy to understand for someone not affiliated to our movement. I wish to bring it to a certain conclusion and culmination, from which can emerge a deeper understanding of the situation for modern humanity in general. Let us first consider what people call culture in an earthly sense. This is everything that raises us in any way beyond our individual egoism as human beings and gathers us into community with other people. Let us take the area of culture and spirit still of most significance for the majority of people today, one which aims to convey our connection with a life of spirit that is not of this world, religious life, in other words, of whatever denomination or confession. Here we gather together with other people with whom we share similar needs of soul. Through education, too, one person cares for another in a soul spiritual sense. When we read a book, we are also led beyond our own immediate individual egoistic life. If the book becomes popular, even to a limited degree, we then share the same thoughts with numerous other people who also read it. And this likewise places us in a certain group of people who experience something similar in their souls. This is an important characteristic of spiritual life, of culture, that it springs from complete freedom, from the individual initiative of each person. But that this earthly cultural life then leads us into community with others, giving rise to groups of people within the entirety of humanity. But for someone who seeks deeper understanding, such commonality at the same level leads us closer to the key event of all earthly evolution, the mystery of Golgotha. Since the mystery of Golgotha took place within the earth's evolution, everything that relates to human community, in a sense, also belongs to this Christ impulse. This is the thing of chief importance, that the Christ impulse does not belong to each separate individual, but to human community. In accord with the nature of Christ Jesus himself, it is a great error to think that an individual as such can have a direct relationship with the Christ. Essentially, Christ lived, died, and was resurrected for humanity in its entirety. And therefore, since the mystery of Golgotha, the Christ event is, as we will return to later, always of immediate relevance whenever any kind of human community develops. If we really understand the world, we find that earthly culture too, springing from the most individual aspect of us, from our personal potential and gifts, also relates to the Christ event. But now, let us consider this earthly culture of ours in its own terms, religious life, education and schooling, art and so on. Through this culture, we enter into a certain relationship with others. And here we have to distinguish between what brings us into relation with other people through our own destiny, our karma, and what is not intrinsically or intimately connected with this karma. On the one hand, we have certain relationships with people that arise in our life. We form new connections with certain people. We have relationships that are nothing other than the outcomes of other relationships we formed in previous lives on earth. And here in this life, in turn, we forge relationships that will give rise to karmic developments in succeeding lives. This produces a whole range of individual relationships with other people. Such connections, intrinsically related to our more intimate karma, must be distinguished from further relationships we enter into through commonality and community, for instance, by virtue of our membership of a religious community, a faith community, or because we are educated in the same way, read the same books and so forth, enjoy the same works of art. These people with whom we are in community on earth are not invariably connected with us through relationships in former lives. There are, however, communities of people who are related to each other karmically, sharing a common destiny. But this is not usually the case with cultural and faith communities. But this leads us back to something else, to the end of the period which we pass in the supersensible world between death and rebirth. When we are close to the time of being reincarnated on earth, we enter into spiritual relationships, since by then we have become mature enough to do so, firstly with the hierarchies of the Angeloi, Archangeloi and Archai, with the higher hierarchies altogether. But we also come close to other human souls in the time preceding our rebirth, people who will have longer to wait than us before they are reborn, We have a whole range of supersensible encounters at this time, having become mature enough for them, before we are drawn back again into earthly life through birth. And these powers we absorb place us back on the earth in a location where it becomes possible for us to experience the kinds of earthly cultural communities I had just described. From what I have said, it will be apparent, above all, that our earthly culture and life of spirit, which we experience as religious people, in our education and upbringing, in the impressions we receive from art and such like, is not dictated and determined merely by earthly things, but by what we previously experienced in supersensible realms before we descended through birth to this earthly culture. Just as a mirror image points us to a reflected reality, so earthly culture points us to what we experienced before we descended into our earthly body. In this respect, there is nothing so intrinsically and truly vividly connected with the supersensible world as this earthly culture, despite the many aberrations apparent in it. In fact, even these aberrations have a meaningful connection to what we experience, albeit in a quite different way, in the supersensible realm. Earthly culture acquires a very distinctive place in the world because it is connected with our life before birth. Nothing else in our earthly life is so closely connected with our pre-birth life as this earthly culture. A spiritual researcher must point this out clearly. He distinguishes earthly culture from other human activities which people on earth are involved in, because his supersensible observations show him that this earthly culture has its origins, its impulses, in supersensible life before birth. And in this respect, it is different in quality from other human experiences. What we can identify in stricter terms as political life, public legislature and rights, the state which establishes order amongst humankind, is different in kind. One can apply the most precise spiritual scientific methodology in studying what this state as such, the political life of rights, has in common with anything else. But no connection will be found between this and a supersensible realm. This sphere is entirely earthly, although we must carefully clarify what is meant by this. What exactly is an earthly legal relationship? It is a relationship of property or ownership. If I own a piece of land, say, I only do so because of political context gives me the exclusive right to make use of it, enabling me to exclude all others from its use or cultivation. Everything based on public law is the same. The sum of all civil laws, and also the sum of everything which a particular community defends as its rights or property, amounts to the life of the state in its narrower sense. This is earthly life per se, and is connected only with the impulses active in us between birth and death. However much the state may sometimes consider itself to have God-given rights, a deeper view of all religious confessions will show us the following. Firstly, what Christ Jesus meant when he said, quote, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's," close quote. By saying this, he sought to counter the aspirations of the Roman Empire by showing that the external life of the state is distinct from all that is a reflection of supersensible life. But everything that seeks to introduce a supersensible impulse into the merely earthly life of the state, for instance, trying to make the state responsible for religious life or education, the latter, sadly, now regarded everywhere as the right approach, was regarded by deeper religious sensibilities in the past as an invitation to the iniquitous prince of this world to hold sway. This, they said, will be the result of merging spiritual, supersensible concerns with the external state. What is meant by the iniquitous prince of this world is not something you will fathom without the aid of spiritual science. This prince holds sway whenever what should govern only earthly circumstances aspires to incorporate spiritual, cultural concerns, and, as we will see, also economic life. The prince entitled to hold sway in the world is the one who aspires only to encompass political relationships in their stricter sense. All that relates to and draws its impulses from our life between birth and death alone. Thus, we have understood the second sphere of the social organism in terms of spiritual science. It is oriented only to the impulses active in us between birth and death. And now, we come to the third sphere, that of economic relations. Picture the fact that economic life places us really into a certain relationship with the world. You will easily come to see the nature of this relationship if you imagine how it might be possible for us to become entirely and exclusively absorbed in it. What would we be if our whole being and all our activity was involved in nothing but outward economic life? We would be nothing more than thinking animals. We only avoid becoming thinking animals by virtue of the rights life that we also engage in, a political life, the life of the state, and also a life of the mind, an earthly culture and spiritual life. Through economic life, we are more or less pushed downward below the human level. But as this occurs, in this sphere specifically, we can develop interests that are most eminently fraternal. In no other sphere can we so easily and self-evidently develop fraternal relations with others, in the fullest sense of the word, as in economic life. What really holds sway in cultural, spiritual life on earth? Basically, it is a personal interest, inner preoccupation of an egoistic nature. People wish religion to save or bless them or make them happy. Education exists to develop a person's particular potential. We enjoy art or practicing art and look to it to enhance our life or bring joy to it or also to nurture our life forces. It is invariably so that egoism of a subtler or grosser kind leads us, for our own sake, to earthly culture. This is quite understandable. In rights life, political life as such, we have something that makes us equal before the law. Here we are concerned with interpersonal relations and the ways they are governed. We are concerned with our rights. Rights do not exist between animals, and this is because that elevates us over them already here in earthly life. In the circumstances obtaining in a religious community, an educational community, and also in a legislative community, we have something that in a sense is based on something to which we lay claim in a self-evident manner. But in the sphere of economic life, precisely if we can overcome our own perspective, something can emerge that is not founded on our own interests and volition. Fraternity, consideration of the other, a way of living that enables the other to experience something through and alongside us. In a spiritual relationship, we receive something because we wish it. In a legal or rights relationship, we lay claim to something if we wish, as we inevitably do, to maintain a dignified life as one among equals. And in economic life, there unfolds something, fraternity, that connects the feelings of one person with those of another. The impulses of fraternal life arise when we create a certain relationship that bridges between what we possess and what the other possesses, and between what we need and the other needs, and so forth. When we increasingly develop this fraternity in economic life, then something else emerges from it. This fraternity in economic life, this fraternal relationship between people, which must illumine economic life if it is to become wholesome and healthy, in a sense rises from it like vapor, so that having developed this fraternity in economic life, educated ourselves to do so, we take it with us through the gate of death and bear it on with us into supersensible life after death. In our earthly perception, economic life seems to be the lowest form of human activity, but within it, there develops something that pulses forth from earthly life, passing through the gateway of death into the supersensible. Thus we have considered the third sphere of the social organism in spiritual scientific terms. It develops something that pushes us down into a subhuman realm in a sense, but we are compensated for this by the fact that we take the fraternity we develop in economic life with us through the gate of death. It stays with us when we enter the world of spirit. Just as earthly culture, the life of the mind, develops, as I described earlier, as a mirror image of pre-birth supersensible existence, so economic life, with the social interest, feelings of human community and fraternity it develops in us, points us forward toward supersensible life after death. Here, therefore, we have distinguished three separate spheres: spiritual cultural life, pointing back to pre-birth supersensible life, the state, in its strict sense, related to impulses that unfold between birth and death, and economic life that points us toward what we will experience after we have passed through the gate of death. The human being is not just an earthly being, but also at the same time a super-earthly one. He bears in him the fruits of what he experienced in his life before birth in the supersensible realm, and he develops the seeds of what he will experience in his life after death. Human life is threefold, and alongside these two forms of reflection of supersensible life, there is a third realm we experience between birth and death that is specifically of the earth. Just as our life itself is threefold, so the social organism in which we live must be threefold in nature if the human soul, in its entirety, is to find its firm and stable foundation within this social organism. If we recognize our place in the cosmos through spiritual science, we discover far deeper reasons for acknowledging that the social organism has to be threefold. We can discern that human beings will degenerate, and in fact have done so in a sense in modern times, leading to the terrible catastrophe of the last 4 years. If everything is centralized, and everything in the outward life of society is informed by chaotic, anarchic disorganization. Gradually, through anthroposophic deepening of our insights, we should come to recognize the nature of human life and grow aware that the entirety of human nature must find its place within humanity and the world as a whole in the way I have described. At the same time, this embodies the right form of Christ knowledge in our day and the near future. This is what is revealed to us if we wish to hearken to the Christ. He himself said, as I have often reiterated, quote, "I am with you always, even unto the end of the world," Close quote. This means that what he uttered was not spoken only in the times when he walked upon earth, but that he continues to speak to us, and we should continue to hearken to him. Besides reading the Gospels, which of course we always continue to do, we should try to attend to what his living presence amongst us can reveal. In the modern era, he reveals to us, as his forerunner John the Baptist said, that we should change our ways. And this will show us a vision of threefold humanity, which also requires us to structure in threefold form the earthly conditions in which we live. People rightly say that Christ died and was resurrected for all humanity, that the mystery of Golgotha is an event concerning all mankind. We can become particularly aware of this today when nation has risen against nation, when they have devastated one another in dire conflict, and when now, after a culmination and crisis in this warfare, instead of pause for contemplation, instead of awareness of the whole human community, a victorious delirium prevails. We must not overlook this. Everything we have experienced in the past 4.5 years, what we are now witnessing, and what will still come, shows those of deeper discernment that humanity has entered a crisis state as far as its awareness of Christ is concerned. And this is because people have lost sight of a proper sense of community, the right sense of connection with each other. It is essential that they start asking how they can rediscover the Christ impulse once more. A simple fact can show us that many are failing to find it. Before the Christ impulse began to work into earth evolution through the mystery of Golgotha, the nation into which Christ Jesus was born considered itself the, in quotes, chosen people, believing that the earth could only prosper if all else dies away, and only the members of this nation fill the whole world. In a sense, this was a firm conviction and matter of faith. The God Yahweh had chosen this people as his own, and he was regarded as the one God. In the times prior to the mystery of Golgotha, this was a justified view amongst the ancient Hebrews, because Christ Jesus was indeed to come forth from this people. But when the mystery of Golgotha occurred on earth, this outlook should have come to an end. After the mystery of Golgotha, it was outdated, and Yahweh consciousness should have ceded to Christ consciousness, which speaks in the same way of all human beings as the people of Yahweh spoke of the members of only one people. It is the tragic fate of the Jewish people that it did not recognize this. But today in many quarters we are witnessing a lapse into such mindsets. Gradually, even if they do not see it or name it in this way, nations are succumbing to a kind of Yahweh, one specific to their own race, whom they worship as their national idol. While people do not speak in the same religious formula as in the past, it is the same outlook couched in modern terms, a modern way of thinking. A way of thinking or habit of mind might be a good way to put it, though nowadays people use a different term. To gain better understanding of it, one might make the concession of adopting this way of thinking for a while, and instead of using the term habit or way of thinking, which I have always used in our circles, to employ the word mentality or mindset. In the modern mentality, therefore, every nation seeks to establish its own distinct national god and promote these national qualities. It is precisely this that has led to nation warring with nation. We find here a lapse into the Yahweh religion, although here it is splintered into many different Yahweh religions. What we're seeing today really is a lapse into Old Testament atavism. Humanity seeks to sunder itself into separate parts across the whole globe, at odds with Christ Jesus, whose living being served all humanity. Mankind seeks to inhabit the diverse national divinities in a Yahweh-like way. Before the mystery of Golgotha, this was justified, but is now outmoded, a lapse into an Old Testament condition. This lapse into the Old Testament mentality will bring with it severe trials for modern humanity, and there is only one remedy for this: to approach the Christ again upon a spiritual path. This gives rise to a very particular question for those interested in spiritual science. In our day, how do we find our way to Christ Jesus out of the inmost impulse of our modern souls? That this is a very serious question. I have often spoken of it in this branch from other perspectives. You can see from the fact that many official adherents of Christianity have really lost sight of the Christ. Nowadays, there are many well-known priests, pastors, and so forth, who speak about the Christ, saying that human beings can gain a connection with him through a certain inner deepening of their sensibility. But if we look more carefully at what these people mean by Christ, one finds there is no difference between this and God in general, what is called God the Father in the Gospels too. Harnack is a theologian of repute, for instance, and here in Switzerland many look up to him. Harnack has published a little book titled The Nature of Christianity, in which he speaks a great deal of Christ. But it is not at all clear that what he says of Christ has any particular relationship with Christ. Actually, there is no reason to relate what he says to Christ at all, since it relates equally to the God Yahweh. For this reason, the whole of title The Nature of Christianity is inwardly untruthful. It only becomes true if we couch it back in the Hebrew tradition by removing references to Christ and replacing them instead by the word Yahweh. This is a truth of which people today have scarcely any inkling. Sermons about Christ resound from countless pulpits round the world, and people believe that these sermons are authentic, that the name of Christ is truly spoken, simply because they hear the word Christ. No one stops to ask whether if one removed references to Christ from a priest's sermon and replaced it with Yahweh, it might not do just as well. In fact, only then will it read correctly. You see, there is a common untruth connected with the profoundest flaws in our time. Please do not think that I wish to criticize anyone here or cast blame. This is not so. I wish only to express a fact. Those embroiled in the profoundest inner untruth, or inner lie, one can say, do not know this, and are certainly people of goodwill in their own way. Nowadays, humanity finds it difficult to approach the truth because of the powerful obduracy with which tradition has established itself. And this inner untruth in respect of such things, which today spreads far and wide, gives rise to that other untruth which today has seized hold of the most diverse domains of life, so that it is hard to see any truth at all remaining. One has to ask where any truth or reality is still to be found. For someone who seeks spiritual scientific insights, the question of how we can find the true path to Christ, to this distinctive divine being to whom the name of Christ rightly belongs, is therefore a very serious one. If our life is merely confined to the span between birth and death on earth, and a soul life that develops in accordance with our capacities and disposition in this realm, then we have no cause to come to Christ, however much goes on in our minds or spirit. If we do not do particular things, which I will describe in a moment, and simply develop between birth and death, as most people do today, then we remain far from the Christ. But how can we approach the Christ? The initiative, even if this sometimes surfaces from the subconscious or an obscure feeling, to seek the path to Christ, to embark on this path, has to come from ourselves. We can find the God who is identical with the Yahweh God simply by living in an ordinary, healthy way. Not finding Yahweh is merely a kind of human illness. Denying God, being an atheist, means in a sense that one is ill. If we develop in any sense in a fully normal way, we will not be atheists, since it is ridiculous to believe that the healthy organism we bear could not be divine in origin. The ex Deo nascimur is something that arises by itself in the social existence of a person who develops healthily. You see, if he does not acknowledge that he is born out of God, he inevitably has a certain defect which comes to expression in his atheism. But this self-evident sense of being born out of God leads us only to the divine in general, which modern pastors, out of an inner lie, call Christ. It is not Christ. We only approach Christ, and I am speaking here of our immediate present, if we go further than simply acknowledging ordinary God-given natural health. You see, we know that the mystery of Golgotha occurred upon the earth because without it, without the Christ impulse, humankind could not have found its way into a truly human life, a life of human dignity. In a sense, we can say that it is not enough to find our human nature between birth and death, but we must also rediscover it if we wish to be Christians in the true sense, if we wish to come close to Christ. We have to rediscover this, our human nature, in the following way. We must seek, must exert ourselves to find the inner honesty to say to ourselves, since the mystery of Golgotha, we are not born without prejudices in respect of our thought world. We are all born with certain biases or prejudices. As soon as we regard the human being as inherently perfect, as Rousseau does, for example, we cannot find the Christ. We can only find him if we know that, as human beings, living after the mystery of Golgotha, we have a flaw which we must remedy or compensate for in what we do in our life here. I am born as a person with prejudices, and have to gradually free myself from these in my thinking. How can I do so? Only by developing interest not only in what I myself think and what I consider right, but also selfless interest in everything human beings can think, all that approaches me, however mistaken I consider it. The more a person insists that his own outlook and opinion is the only right one, and is only interested in this, the more he sunders himself from the whole world's evolution, from Christ. The more a person develops social interest in the views of others, even if he thinks them wrong or misguided, the more he will feel in his inmost soul the truth of a saying of Christ, which today must be interpreted in accordance with the new Christ language. Quote, "Verily, I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me." Close quote. Christ never ceases to reveal himself ever and again to human beings, until the end of all earthly days. He says this to those who wish to hearken to him, quote, "What one of the least of your brethren think, you must regard as me thinking in him. And I feel with you as you measure the other's thoughts against your thoughts, having social interest in what unfolds in the other's soul. whatever you find as opinion, as outlook on life, in one of the least of your brothers, seek therein for me. Close quote. It is thus that Christ speaks into our life of thought, seeking to reveal himself in a new way. We are approaching this time to the people of the 20th century. This is not Harnack's God, who might equally well be the Yahweh God, and actually is. Christ is, by contrast, the God of all humanity. We do not find him if we remain egotistically within our own thoughts, but only by measuring our own thoughts against those of others, enlarging our interest in inner tolerance for all that is human, saying to ourselves that we are born with prejudices, but can be reborn out of the thoughts of all human beings into an encompassing social thought sensibility. Then we can find in ourselves the Christ impulse. If I do not regard myself alone as the source of all I think, but right into my inmost soul as a part of humanity, then I have found the path to Christ. This must today be called the thinking path to Christ. We can develop and educate ourselves in vital ways by acquiring a sense for the importance of how others think, thereby correcting the outlook we bear intrinsically within us through dialogue with others. This has to become a serious life task. If this task were not to make headway amongst humankind, people would lose the modern path to Christ, which passes through thoughts and thinking. The other path passes through the will. Here, too, people have embarked in a very misguided direction that does not lead to Christ, but away from him. In this other realm, too, we must find the path to Christ. Youth still has its own natural idealism, but in general, humanity today has grown dry and prosaic. It is proud of what is often called pragmatism, although this is only practical in a certain narrow sense. Modern humanity looks very askance at ideals drawn from a source in the spirit. Youth still retains its ideals. Never before in history has the life of older generations been at such variance with that of the younger. A salient characteristic of our time is a failure to understand human nature. Yesterday, I spoke of the deep gulf that divides the proletariat from the middle classes. But the older and the younger generation are similarly divided and scarcely understand each other. We should pay very great attention to this. Let us try to understand the idealism of youth. Fine, you may say, but in fact great efforts are made nowadays to quash this idealism. And this is done by depriving young people of an education that addresses their imagination through fairy tales, legends, through all that leads them away from arid, external sensory facts and realities. Actually, it is very hard to successfully quash this natural, youthful, elemental idealism. It is a lovely, vital quality, and yet cannot be the only human attribute, since really this idealism emerges from the ex Deo Nascimur, from the divine ground of being that is identical with the Yahweh God. This must be complemented and enlarged ever since the mystery of Golgotha took place on the earth. Alongside it, there must be something else too, an education, a self-education for idealism. Alongside the innate idealism of youth, we have to ensure that an acquired, self-developed idealism emerges in human communities. Not just the idealism of young blood and enthusiasm, but something we acquire by some kind of initiative. This is self-instilled idealism, which is not lost as we age, and which opens the way to Christ because it is something that has to be acquired through our endeavors between birth and death. Try to sense the great difference between idealism of the blood and acquired, self-instilled idealism. The great difference between the fire of youth and the fire that comes from taking hold of the life of spirit and can be continually rekindled because we have developed it within us, independently of our bodily development. This is the second idealism, the acquired or reborn idealism, rather than the one inherent in us. This is the path of the will to Christ, while the other is the path of thought. Do not think abstract paths to Christ, but seek these tangible ones. The path of thought, through which we become inwardly tolerant of the views and outlooks of all humanity, gaining social interest in the thoughts of other people, and the path of the will that I have described. Nothing abstract, but acquiring, developing idealism. In developing this idealism, or instilling it in young people as they grow, which is especially necessary, you will find that people thereby develop a sense for doing not just what the outer world impels them to. Out of this idealism spring the impulses to do more than the sensory world impels them to act out of the spirit. In what we do in acquired, self-developed idealism, we realize what Christ wished. He did not descend to earth from non-earthly realms to fulfill merely earthly aims, but to realize super-earthly ones. But we only grow one with Him if we cultivate idealism in ourselves, so that Christ, who is super-earthly within the earth, can work in us. Only in this reborn idealism is realized the intent of the Pauline phrase, quote, "Not I, but Christ in me," close quote. If we do not seek to acquire self-developed idealism as our inner moral rebirth, all that we can say is, quote, "Not I, but Yahweh in me," close quote. But if we develop the idealism we must acquire and nurture, then we can indeed say, quote, "Not I, but Christ in me," close quote. These two paths I have described are the way to truly find the Christ, and pursuing them, our speech will no longer be inwardly untruthful. Then we will speak of the Christ as the God of our inner rebirth, as opposed to Yahweh, who is the God of our merely physical birth. This difference and distinction is one we must discover today, for this alone is what will lead us to truly social feelings, real social interest in others. Developing acquired idealism in ourselves, we will also find love for others. You can sermonize as much as you like about loving your fellow human beings, but it is doing no more than telling the stove to heat itself. However nicely you speak to it, it will not get hot unless you put coal or wood in it. Then there will be no need to impress upon it its duty to warm the room. Preaching about love, love, and more love is mere words. But working to help people experience a rebirth of idealism that sustains them in life, you are kindling neighborly love too in the human soul. As you develop idealism within you yourself, your soul will lead you forth from egoism into self-reliant interest and feeling for others. However, one thing you will find as you pursue this twofold path of thought and will I have described in relation to the renewal of Christianity is an enhanced sense of responsibility toward everything we think and do, arising both from thoughts that are inwardly tolerant and interested in the thoughts of others, and from the reborn will emerging through self-developed idealism. Someone concerned to develop inwardly will, if he pursues both these paths, feel an enhanced, refined inner sense of responsibility toward all that he thinks and does. And this will be different in quality from the ordinary sense of responsibility of someone who does not pursue these paths. Can we discern an inner sense of responsibility which asks us whether we can justify a thought or action, not just in regard to those closest to us, our immediate environment, but also in terms of our connection with a supersensible world of spirit? Can I justify something, knowing that everything I do here on earth is inscribed in an Akashic record of eternal significance, where it goes on taking effect? Ah, how strongly you feel this supersensible responsibility toward everything. Like a being who stands behind you and looks over your shoulder, it approaches and admonishes you if you seek the twofold path of Christ. It continually tells you that you are responsible for all that you think and do, not just as regards the world, but in relation to the divine spiritual realm. This being who looks over our shoulder, enhancing and refining our feelings of responsibility, and making them quite different in nature from what they used to be, is what leads us very close to the Christ, who passed through the mystery of Golgotha. I wanted to speak today about this path to Christ, about how it can be found and how it becomes apparent in the being I have just characterized. You see, this Christ path is intimately connected with the deepest social impulses and tasks of our time. And I wish to impress this on you in our gathering today. The end of Lecture 3.